Ignition sequence start. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. All engine running. Liftoff. We have a liftoff.
Fly me to the moon. Let me play among the stars. Let me see what spring is like on a Jupiter and Mars.
Hello, and welcome to Season 2, Episode 7 of Space Talks, a half-hour science-based show with an interest in all things space. I'm Stephen Lowry, along with co-host Tim Woods on Vancouver Island. And hello, Tim. Tell us of today's topic.
Well, you know, with all the spending to explore the universe, it's really not surprising that a lot of people take exception to that tax money going out the window. And they make the point that we've got a lot of problems right here on Earth. And one of those problems requiring a lot of attention is climate change. So today's topic is a bit of a Hail Mary, I think. It's got a name, space-based geoengineering. And by that, what they mean is a consideration of anything we might do in space to mitigate the current and future risks of the warming planet.
Well, I certainly understand why script writers for science fiction movies love this topic, but it sure seems more like fantasy than science to me. However, before we get to whatever science does exist for this kind of research, do we have any updates that we have coming our way?
You know, I do have one, Steve. In fact, I think we both have one. So here's mine. I thought we should catch up, or in fact, maybe slow down is a more accurate way to say this, to see what's happening to the Boeing Starliner space capsule. And the short answer, not much.
Well, that's hardly exciting news. Not much is happening. Why not?
Well, NASA needs new suppliers for space capsules that can transport people to the International Space Station or other Earth orbit missions. And Boeing was one of the lucky recipients of funding. They got $4.2 billion US dollars. However, their seven-seater has been grounded for over a year, and the company's only news seems to always be about further delays. The first crewed flight has been pushed beyond 2023 now, and it will be no earlier than March of 24. And to top things off after that, it seems like that will be the only flight next year. And this is a long way from what they'd promised.
So what's the holdup? Something like staffing shortages at Pearson Airport?
It's getting to that point where you have to wonder, scratch your head. They've just had this long list of problems for several years now. And as soon as they fix one, another one pops up. It's a whack-a-mole situation. I'm just going to read you what they have said just a little while ago about the next delay. Quote, this recent postponement is likely related to recent concerns having to do with the spacecraft's parachute system and the discovery of flammable tape within the vehicle. A key technical issue has to do with the spacecraft's parachutes, which have demonstrated a lower than anticipated failure load limit. And I think we know what that means, Steve, crash landings.
So the bottom line is, this is a major headache for NASA. Relying on SpaceX for every crew and supply shipment to the ISS, unless they keep writing checks to the Russians for transport. And speaking of SpaceX, on December 3rd of this year, the United States Space Force, yes, you heard me right, the U.S. has a new branch of the military, shall we say, above the Air Force. The SpaceX Falcon Heavy will launch the super-secret unmanned X-37B space plane on its seventh mission to space. This long-duration orbital vehicle has previously set world records for remaining in space, with its latest lasting 908 days. And though the launch will be televised, shortly thereafter feeds will be terminated, so its orbital characteristics can't be calculated. That is, until some enterprising amateur spots it, which they have done so in previous missions.
Well, I don't know whether to cheer for that particular endeavor or not. It sounds scary stuff. Our topic is not, it's scary in a different kind of way. Geospace geoengineering is supposed to try to address some of the scary risks associated with climate change. And I understand, Steve, that a lot of people are going to be skeptical about this, but we don't need to be cheerleaders here on Space Talks to take a look at what's being considered when it comes to efforts to fix and mitigate climate change. And I'm going to make a couple of points to get us started. First off, greenhouse gas effect that is driving the warming climate is clearly a space-based phenomenon. We humans are generating a lot of the carbon emissions that are lingering in the upper atmosphere and preventing solar energy from escaping into space. And that's, after all, what the greenhouse effect is all about.
Oh, boy. I think I get to mention one of my favorite topics here, which is wavelengths. The greenhouse effect, in case some listeners don't know, refers to circumstances where the relative short wavelengths of visible solar light pass through our transparent atmosphere, are absorbed on the ground, but the subsequent longer wavelengths of the infrared heat radiation, and they're trapped in our atmosphere. And the trapping of the long wave infrared radiation leads to a cycle of increasing heat.
It's a vicious circle. So the problems are being caused here on terra firma, and the climate impacts are, of course, being felt here on terra firma, but all this extra carbon and methane is lingering high above the Earth's surface. And the second point I wanted to make to get things started here is that a lot of people are focusing on researching the problem and advancing solutions that are terra firma based, and they get pretty wired up when they start hearing about techno fixes or any sort of workarounds. Essentially, their concern is that it's been a struggle to convince people that the issue is caused by human behavior, and their worry is that it will be even harder to get people to take this seriously if they can brush it off as being a small problem that will quickly be solved by some kind of fancy new gadget.
Yes, and let's not forget that incredible line made famous by former Vice President Al Gore when he uttered an inconvenient truth. And by that he meant that if you have to accept the truth of man-made climate change, that's going to justify some inconvenient adjustments like smaller cars or shutting down coal mining, which is anathema to the American way of life.
Exactly. So for the past few years, we've seen this debate playing out among scientists, writers, policy folks. Should we put all our efforts into reducing emissions, or is it a good time to spend some of that effort trying to mitigate the impact of extreme weather events, like the ones we've been seeing this year, forest fires, pop-up fierce hurricanes, droughts, and floods?
Well, this isn't really a show about public policy or politics. Rather, it's a show about space and the science, which we use to understand and explore our place in the universe. However, that's not going to stop us from looking at some of the science and ethical aspects of today's topic of space-based geoengineering. So go ahead, my friend Tim. What have you got up first?
Well, let's work from the ground up, so to speak. The first idea is actually one that has been widely dismissed by just about every country except China, and that is cloud seeding. Now, you have to go all the way back to the 1940s to trace the history of cloud seeding, and an American scientist named Vincent Schaefer, he speculated that he could use dry ice to induce the formation of ice crystals in supercooled water droplets. The following year, he and two other smart fellows used an aircraft to seed the clouds and make it snow. And the next stop is a few years later in the Cold War that has both the United States and the Soviet Union dabbling in this new science. Sure, there was some thinking about agriculture and water resource management, but the big money, well, that was on military application, something to impact enemy supply lines. And Steve, I'm sure you're not surprised.
Hardly at all, Tim, being a fan of the Cold War. You know, and I clearly remember going to Europe in 1960, and virtually every airplane that you saw in the sky was a military one. Those were scary times and later prompted me to extensively research the Cold War from 1945 to 1991. And indeed, I did produce the Cold War Hot Music series of 47 episodes about this historical era.
Steve, that was some great radio you produced for that series. And I hope that you're really proud of what you accomplished. And on your own, I can't take any credit at all. But let's get back to cloud seeding. It was in the next round of research in the 70s and 80s when doubts began to overwhelm that early optimism. And of course, with the rise of the environmental movement at the time, people started to question the impact, the collateral damage, you might say, that was being done to local ecosystems. Since the 1990s, that technology of cloud seeding has been used to some small extent to enhance precipitation for agriculture, manage water resources, and reduce hail damage.
And speaking of the latter, I wonder how many listeners are aware that in 1996, insurance companies in Alberta formed the Alberta Severe Weather Management Society and began the Alberta Hail Suppression Project. The insurance industry pays $3 million per year to fly aircraft into storms And those aircraft are equipped with two methods of delivering silver iodide into a storm cell. They either have flares on the wings, which can be lit for seeding at the bottom of the storm, while canisters below the aircraft deliver the product into the top of the storm. The tiny silver iodide particles attract water droplets in the cloud and will create thousands of small hailstones instead of letting them coalesce into larger, more destructive ones.
How much damage are this hail really going to be doing for this kind of action to be necessary?
Well, I was totally surprised. A little research showed that in 2014, hail cost $450 million in Alberta. In 2016, it cost $50 million. In 2017, it caused $80 million in damages. And the big one was in 2020, when damages cost $1.5 billion.
Wow. That's some serious money. Well, good for Alberta. And we must mention that China's ongoing cloud seeding program is actually overseen by something called the China Meteorological Administration. And various provinces and municipalities there have implemented cloud seeding projects, not to mitigate hail damage, but to augment water resources. You know, people might remember the 2008 Summer Olympics, when China seeded clouds prior to the opening ceremony to keep it dry for those ceremonies. And Steve, I do remember that amazing opening ceremony, but I'd forgotten the cloud seeding strategy before doing some of the research we've done for today's show.
It is a bit surprising when others have largely moved on, isn't it? China isn't afraid to go its own way, and they've been using a lot of silver nitrate to encourage precipitation and alleviate drought conditions in parts of the country. And from the reading I've done, there's a lot of evidence that China is all in when it comes to cloud seeding. And to be fair, there's no mainstream news reporting suggesting anything about this being a weaponizing of weather.
Well, that's good news. Well, let's keep going then, as in up in space to real space, and see what some of these other ideas are that are being considered as mitigating strategies. And the next one up is a little far-fetched. It's called solar radiation management. And for those keeping score on the acronyms, it's also known as SRM. At this point, SRM is a set of theoretical geoengineering techniques that have not come close yet to practicality. The goal is to reflect some of the sun's energy that arrives to our little planet and increases the planet's albedo. And I'm not going to admit that that was a new word for me, Steve. How about you? Are you on top of the albedo?
Well, actually, yes. I came across this term while taking an introductory astrophysics course at Carleton University in Ottawa. And I found out that albedo is the fraction of sunlight that is diffusely reflected by a celestial body, the Earth included, and that's measured on a scale from 0 to 1. Light-colored objects reflect more sunlight and have a higher albedo score, and dark objects typically absorb more sunlight, thus having a lower albedo score. Now, to compare the Earth and the Moon, the Earth has an albedo of 0.37, and that's three times that of the Moon's 0.12.
So that means that while we think the Moon is quite bright when it's full, if we were on the Moon, the Earth would appear three times as bright. That's quite amazing.
But how would it be possible to make a sizable dent in the amount of solar radiation reaching the atmosphere? What are we going to do, put up a giant parasol in the sky, sort of like the James Webb Space Telescope has, to keep it cool?
Well, it might be that, Steve. There are a couple of methods under study, and one is called stratospheric aerosol injection. What we're talking about here is sulfur dioxide particles injected into the atmosphere as an aerosol. The particles would then scatter sunlight and, in consequence, reduce the amount of solar radiation reaching the ground. The research now being carried out includes learning more about atmospheric chemistry and, not surprisingly, trying to figure out what the risks might be with this kind of enterprise.
Tim, you did mention about sulfur dioxide particles being a mitigating factor for stopping infrared radiation and heating up the atmosphere. That great big meteor impact in the Yucatan Peninsula, which ended up wiping out the dinosaurs, actually spewed up a whole lot of sulfur dioxide into the atmosphere. And indeed, it blocked thermal radiation from reaching the Earth. And for a period of about 10 years, there was virtually no summer on the Earth. It was extremely cold, and it wiped out 90% of all vegetation. With the herbivores gone, the carnivorous dinosaurs had nothing to eat, and they died out. So yeah, we know that sulfur dioxide will cool a planet, and we know that methane will heat it up. So what have we got next here, Tim?
Well, we're going to go on to marine cloud brightening, and it's a nice segue that you've given us here, because there's already quite a bit of international research being carried out on this one. And essentially what we're talking about is injecting a fine sea spray into the atmosphere over the ocean. The water vapor condenses on the sea spray and increases the albedo of the clouds, reflecting more radiation back into space and thereby preventing some degree of warming to the ocean. And of course, we all know about the damage that's being done to our coral reefs by rising sea temperatures. So this is obviously a huge benefit, at least as a potential.
But you kind of make it sound like a slam dunk, but somehow, you know, these things never seem to work out as promised. They sort of backfire, something like when they introduced rabbits into Australia as a source of food. So what's the catch, do you suspect, with cloud brightening?
You know, first I'm going to have to say, does it work? Or at least answer that question. And the experiments are suggesting that the cooling impact would be real. But there's unfortunately going to be an impact on precipitation in the sense that it produces a drying impact in one locale and increases precipitation in another. And you can just imagine the lawyers having a field day with that one.
Oh, yes. Hey, Val, those are my clouds and that's my water.
And many of those lawyers are going to be working for governments, which would have their own fears and doubts about somebody else fooling around with Mother Nature. So we'll get to that part of the story, but let's stay with this optimistic view. Do the champions really have a case that this is going to work? Well, from my scan of things, one proponent, John Latham, would have you say absolutely. He's been working with the Cloud Brightening Project, which is an international consortium of scientists, and they've been at this for 30 years. So Latham and others recently published a paper that captured results from some modeling that they had done. Not a real-world example, but modeling nevertheless, using the proposed technique of spraying sea salt particles to the layer just underneath stratocumulus clouds over three different ocean regions. And the bottom line? Well, the modeling delivered the anticipated results. There was an increase in reflected radiation, which did keep the sea surface temperature static, despite a doubling of the carbon dioxide they had put into this modeled atmosphere. So keeping in mind that before you start worrying about the impact on precipitation patterns, at first you have to believe there's going to be some kind of an upside. And having marine clouds reflect more solar radiation in sufficient measure does seem to make a difference.
Well, I suppose a person could quibble with us here and say the work being proposed is taking place within our atmosphere and not in space. And that would be a fair point, but the work is being done to stop or reduce the measure of solar radiation, and that's spacey. Spacey is a word. And the other point would be, this isn't a strategy to make it rain. It's a strategy to put humans in charge of the atmosphere and its relationship with our sun.
You know, the scientists involved in this project make a pretty compelling argument about the urgency of protecting our coral reefs from the impact of rising sea temperatures. And as they say, desperate times, desperate measures. So here's a little Space Talks shorthand for what's at stake if those sea temperatures continue to rise in terms of the health of those coral reefs. Now, the reefs themselves are ecosystems, and they have host a tremendous biodiversity, and that's already at risk. We're already seeing a decline in marine biodiversity, and the survival of coral reefs is clearly in play. Second, there's the economic impact. And that comes in the form of food security for many coastal communities that rely on coral reefs for food, and the tourism industry that provides employment to huge numbers of people whose livelihoods would be at risk. Third, it's appropriate to add the cultural loss that is part of this story. There are many communities where traditions and livelihoods, even identity, are all wrapped up with that relationship with a healthy coral reef. And finally, there's that cascading effect with damage to coral reefs in terms of climate impacts from rising sea temperatures. And here's what I mean. Coral reefs act as a natural barrier to coastal communities vis-a-vis storm impacts, rising sea levels, and so on. I've also learned that coral reefs act as a carbon sink. So it's a vicious circle phenomena where climate change damage to coral reef actually accelerates further damage.
Well, Tim, that's one of the many stories we're learning these days, that one ecosystem impacts another. Rising temperatures melt glaciers, melting glaciers raise sea levels and threaten the Gulf Stream and so on. Kill a butterfly in Kenya and California sinks into the ocean. I'm actually not surprised to hear that scientists are looking at all means possible to decrease the solar energy that makes its way to the ground. There's another example that's actually quite similar and involves the color white. Research is being done to make a purer white that will reflect even more solar radiation, and it would be used in the manufacturing of paint. A little while ago, I read about Purdue University scientists making a purer white paint, which set a Guinness World Record. It increased sunlight reflection to 98.1%, which is a vast improvement over most white paints, which reflect only 85% of sunlight. So on one hand, you've got all the blacktop road surfaces soaking up the sun and re-radiating heat. But imagine if a significant percentage of walls or even rooftops were employing reflective paint of this kind. I don't believe this particular paint has made it yet to the store shelves, but that's the intent. See if they can mass produce a product of this sort at a price that works in the marketplace.
It does sound quite practical, and it makes intuitive sense. I mean, we've all stepped on a hot black pavement and have to understand that were that not so deep and black and absorbing all that heat, that would be a good thing. And the flip side of that coin would be white or white. So there's also the greening of rooftops to mitigate heat gain. And these two directions are a lot more practical than the next truly space-based strategy I'm about to mention, which actually sounds like an idea that a grade 9 science student might come up with after having too many of those energy drinks, Steve. Imagine if we built some big, really big mirrors or reflectors of some sort, put them in space so big that they could redirect enough sunlight to cool the Earth down. What do you think of that?
I think I saw that in a Superman comic book with Lex Luthor doing something like that. It might be a little far-fetched. Have we managed to find anybody with an actual degree from an accredited university who's working on something like this?
Well, yes, actually, we were there in February of this year, 2023, none other than the United Nations came up with a study and they released it, and it has a title, One Atmosphere, an Independent Expert Review on Solar Radiation Modification.
If that isn't a punchline or a movie plot from a James Bond thriller, I don't know what is. So what else did this study have to recommend?
This is a serious study, Steve. So up front, the summary document is all about the unknowns of this science and the importance of actually fixing the problems down here on Earth, cutting back on emissions and so on. The scientists reviewing the concept and the research to date came back with a measure of agreement that we need to take this seriously. So here's some of that headline news. Number one, they're suggesting a panel be created with a mandate to explore and review the evidence of how this might work, what problems it might create, aside from mitigating climate change from a warming planet. Number two, they're also suggesting a governance framework be developed that could sanction small ground-based experiments or even larger deployment experiments. In other words, things getting real. Number three is another kind of governance framework, a new one that would explore our management of the stratosphere. Essentially, there is next to no laws in place about what goes on in our stratosphere. And finally, Steve, you're going to feel pretty pumped to hear this one. Space Talks, our little radio show, is very much reflective of the last recommendation made by this UN panel of experts in a study released in February of this year on the topic of solar radiation management. And that recommendation, which we are all taking very seriously here on the Voice of the Shuswap, a recommendation I can add that I personally...
Okay, Tim, enough already. We're all sitting here on tenterhooks. What is this recommendation which you expound?
Well, the UN wants us all, us Earthlings, to talk more about solar radiation management. And I'm going to read you the opening paragraph from that panel's recommendations word for word. A globally inclusive conversation of solar radiation modification should be promoted. The conversation process on SRM needs to involve discussion on a broad range of issues with all stakeholders, as many, especially in the global south, are not currently engaged in SRM discussion and research. Steve, you and I are having a conversation right now.
Oh, I knew we were cutting edge material, so kudos all around, I say. If the science of this idea is tough, I can't find the words to say how tough it would be to get a yes in terms of some sort of political agreement.
It's a massive undertaking to even imagine that, Steve. I agree. You're absolutely right. But I'm worried about getting to yes on any action is going to become a problem given how critical the situation is in terms of climate change. And I'm going to try to make some kind of a comparison to sort of say, how hard is it going to be to do this solar radiation modification? Well, imagine being on a plane whose engines have shut down and there's just one chance to land on a distant runway. But you know that by lowering the undercarriage, it'll slow the plane down and might result in a crash landing short of the runway. Now, if you don't lower the undercarriage at all, it will assuredly result in a crash landing. So at some point on that descent, you have only one chance to make a safe landing, and that's by lowering the undercarriage before touchdown. So meanwhile on board, you've got some passengers, but no pilots. They've already jumped ship. We've got, say, I don't know, three lawyers, a soldier, and a fellow that has previously been on a plane that crashed. And I hope you're beginning to see my point. These passengers need to make a decision about when to lower that landing gear. But if the debate goes on too long, well, no decision would itself be fatal.
Reminds me of that management phrase, paralysis by analysis. What a rosy picture you paint, my friend. You know, I think we've exhausted the SRM option, the solar radiation modification, for those keeping tab. And it's time to see if there's any less controversial plans to use space technology to help our manage our climate woes. Here's your last chance, Tim.
I'm taking it, Steve. There is one role that is already being put to good use, and it's going to be play an even bigger role moving forward, and that's space-based monitoring of our atmosphere. And what's happening on the ground is necessary, and we need to know more about it. Satellites already play a crucial role in monitoring and collecting data on various climate-related parameters. A couple of episodes prior to this one, we actually mentioned a new Canadian initiative to upgrade our satellite climate monitoring. And all of that data is going to be collected and is essential to understanding climate change, assessing impact, and developing effective mitigation strategies that are more likely strategies to be played out right here on Earth.
I believe you're referring to RADARSAT Plus, which is indeed a continuing Canadian initiative announced in October of this year by the Government of Canada. It's allocating $1 billion to the Canadian Space Agency to support immediate and future satellite Earth observation data needs, used to design and develop a replacement satellite for the three satellites which have been working together to provide daily images to Canada's land and marine approaches, as well as images of the Arctic and other countries. So hooray for Canada.
So here we are. We're going to wrap up this somewhat surprising episode of Space Talks, where we're usually talking about all the amazing new activity in space, human exploration. Only today, with a look back to the impact it might have in helping us mitigate climate change. And what we've seen is a focus on ways to reduce the amount of solar radiation that reach our planet. And the hope is that we'll find a way to steer some portion of that future solar radiation away from the planet and stop making matters worse. So that's all the time we have today. And please join us again. This is Tim Woods.
And Stephen Lowry saying, so long, and we'll see you next time on
Space Talks.
Fly me to the moon. Let me play among the stars. Let me see what spring brings.